are missing from one of the readings. It's my rejoinder to Michael Eldridge, and it really, really helps if you find that. In fact, it would be a great favor to me and to one another if you discover that sort of thing. Call me at home. I'm in the Ithaca phone book, and tell me right away, because it would have been very easy to Xerox those pages and have them available this morning. I think we gave the campus store, I believe, a full set of pages, and something went wrong in the reproduction. But that's a great favor to me and ultimately to you all, because then we'll avoid that kind of glitch, which does happen occasionally. It's not a perfect world. So if there's that kind of a problem, not after about 10 at night, but feel free. In fact, I'd really urge you to call me as soon as you see it, because we can make amends. I will find out exactly what the situation is and have that extra page or two, I'm not sure, available on Thursday. So read the rest of the material, and you can read the final page just before your sections. Someone also asked about office hours. The policy I have is this. Over the years, I've found it extremely frustrating to have definite office hours and then get into interesting conversations with one of you or the other, with three or four or five students waiting in the hall to see me, because it just puts a damper on anything remotely like leisure and an interest in ideas that is more than superficial. I do make every effort, however, to see you by appointment, so that if you want to see me, I almost always am able to arrange a time within one or two or three days, and often then that means that we can take 20 minutes, a half an hour, a full hour together, rather than this kind of pressured situation of people waiting and all of us feeling somewhat uncomfortable about the time. So it is office hours by appointment, but I do try to save quite a bit of time for exactly that purpose. This is the kind of course where it really is utterly appropriate that there is time for leisurely conversation. The main problem that I have had with the teaching assistants over the years is that they are too giving of their time to you all. Jim Tantillo and others over the years, I've had to occasionally say, Jim, you're going to be 50 years old before you finish your degree if you don't spend a little less time with your students. I'm really very proud of the TAs. We've had some outstanding TAs over the years, and one of the hallmarks of their commitment has been a willingness to spend a lot of time with you as individuals or in small groups. So you can work out, I think your TAs, Carl Johnson and Jim Tantillo, will work out their own arrangements. You can talk about that in a section, but they also have been very, very generous in giving of their time to sit down with you individually and talk about issues. Carl or Jim, are there other announcements that we need? Usually, we pass out the question sheets for the following week on Thursdays so that you'll have the full week to work with them. Jim? Yes. We will. We have a kind of course secretary of sorts in Inferno Hall, Marion Hovenkamp. She's in room 8. I think it's 8A. Marion Hovenkamp, H-O-V-E-N-C-A-M-P. And we will from now on leave extra copies of the handouts with her, and she will have a little bookcase. I think it'll be marked such so that you won't even have to catch her in. Generally, try to be reasonably responsible on the handouts, not too often to take extra copies if you forget them, because we're very budget conscious this year. But if you miss them in class, and we usually print a few extras, so once in a while if you happen to forget it for a section or something, you might pick up an extra copy that way, but don't do that too often or the system begins to break down. Other announcements? Good. The topic I want to begin to address today is the subject that I entitle Religion and God. And I draw heavily from a fascinating book, The Meaning and End of Religion, The Meaning and End of Religion by Wilfred Cantwell Smith. It's W-I-L-F-R-E-D, Wilfred Cantwell, C-A-N-T-W-E-L-L, Smith. And he raises some extremely interesting questions about the suitability of the term religion itself. He points out, and I can remember the sense of excitement when I first read the book, because some of these ideas were quite new to me, and I thought very important ideas. He points out that relatively few languages historically have had any term which is the equivalent of our modern term religion. Even more difficult, he says, was it to find any equivalent for the plural form religions. He writes, and I quote, "One is tempted indeed to ask whether there is a closely equivalent concept for our term religion in any culture which has not been influenced by the modern West." He says that he's tempted to ask whether there is a closely equivalent concept for our term religion in any culture which has not been influenced by the modern West. This much is clear, he argues, and I think he makes the case really quite convincingly, that throughout most of history, people have been able to be religious without the assistance of any special term such as the term religion, and particularly without the intellectual analysis which the term religion implies. He concludes, and I quote, he says, "I have come to feel that in some ways it is probably easier to be religious without the concept, that the notion of religion can become an enemy to piety. One might almost say that the concern of the religious man is with God, the concern of the observer is with religion." This is too quippish, yet it is not absurd. Let me repeat that. It's a very, very interesting quote. He says, "I have come to feel that in some ways it is probably easier to be religious without the concept, that the notion of religion can become an enemy to piety. One might almost say that the concern of the religious man is with God, the concern of the observer is with religion." This is too quippish, yet it is not absurd. This is on page 23 of his book that I referred to a moment ago. Smith points out, the title, The Meaning and End of Religion. Smith points out that the rise of the concept of religion may in some ways be correlated with a decline in the actual practice of religion. The term religious, he notes, is easier to get at. Its use today is probably more appropriate from a descriptive analytical standpoint. The term religious refers to a quality of people's lives. It refers to a way of looking at reality. It's not so much a matter of religion as an activity or compartment of life, but rather as a way of viewing and living all of life. We tend sometimes today to think of our recreational life or our social life or our academic life or our business life and our religious life and so on. And Smith argues that that is really a rather strange business in terms of the way religion historically has actually affected people, that for the most part, to be religious was not so much a matter of religion as an activity or compartment of life, to repeat, but rather as a way of viewing and living all of life. For the early Christians, to take a specific example, and I think much the same could be said of Judaism and Islam, as well as some other religions, the importance of the term faith should be noted. This was also the key term throughout much of the Middle Ages. And faith was understood not as the body of doctrines, not as the faith in the sense of what Orthodox Catholics or Presbyterians or whoever believe, but faith was understood as a dynamic living process. It was the quality, the kind of relationship that one had with the living God, a relationship of trust, obedience, of worship, of a sense of awe and mystery and so on. A living dynamic response to not religion, but to the living God. For instance, in St. Paul's epistles in the New Testament, we have the concept of faith as essentially relational. It is faith as the quality of one's trust and obedience to God. And it's only in the later New Testament writings, for instance, in the pastoral epistles in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, that we begin to see a kind of shift where the writer begins to speak of the faith and keeping the faith in the sense of correct doctrine. But the original, the earlier sense of faith, which also was very prominent in much of Judaism, was faith as the living dynamic response. There's a similar shift in meaning in the New Testament in the term righteousness. The term righteousness in the Pauline epistles is always seen as a kind of byproduct or dimension of the relationship between the individual and God. It's not seen as something which one possesses in her own right. It's not something that she somehow has or he has that he can look at. I have now righteousness. Righteousness is a kind of epiphenomenon, a kind of aura or something that surrounds and emanates from the quality of the relationship with God. Similarly, with the word faith. Now, the Middle Ages may have been a very religious period, writes Wilfred Cantwell Smith, but no one, and I quote him here, so far as I have been able to ascertain, ever wrote a book specifically on religion. Very interesting. An age that we think of as very religious, but people are not writing books on religion. The term religio, R-E-L-I-G-I-O, in Latin, occurs frequently during the Middle Ages, but its meaning is much closer to our term piety than to our term religion. Now, Smith argues that a gradual change took place from about the 17th century onwards. There was a division of interest from the individual's personal sense, there was a diversion of interest, I'm sorry, a diversion of interest from the individual's personal sense of the holy, the personal sense of God, to what Wilfred Cantwell Smith refers to as, quote, the observable product or historical deposit of its outworking, end quote. A shift from the personal sense of the holy to, quote, the observable product or historical deposit of its outworking. Religious truth becomes not so much the dynamic participation in divine reality as the propositional statement about that reality. The term religio now comes to refer to the system of ideas, beliefs, cultic practices, and so on. In 1550, Smith points out, if one asked, and this is just a rough date, he's trying to place it roughly, if one asked about a person, e jusne philosophia vera est, this would have meant, is his love of wisdom genuine? But from the time of the Enlightenment on, it would have meant, and still means today, is his philosophy true? This is a very, very interesting historical shift from the Ježišne filosofia vera est is his philosophy, vera, true, we would translate it. Does he have correct ideas? Is she thinking properly? From the older meaning, is her love of wisdom, is his love of wisdom genuine? Is there a true, a committed, sincere relationship to truth, to God, to what one considers ultimate? The intellectualizing of the concept religion appears to be part of the Western mind's attempt to assert its domination over the world by analyzing and conceptualizing it. I think this has been overemphasized perhaps by some writers, but I think it's essentially accurate that the intellectualizing of the concept of religion appears to be part of the Western mind's attempt to assert its domination over the world by analyzing and conceptualizing it. It's very important to remember that the Greeks thought about the gods, about God, but apparently not about religion in the abstract. Hindus had no name for Hinduism. Rather, if you ask them about their religion or their practices, they would say, it is our custom to, and then they would describe what we would call a religious practice or belief. But they had no concept Hinduism. They just were aware of the specific things that they did of a religious nature. Classical Hebrew had no word for religion. Rather, they spoke of the fear or reverence of the Lord. Let me put a chart on the screen here that I think captures this shift rather nicely. If you go back into the 15th century, is there a focusing mechanism on this? Or is that reasonably clear? Anyone an expert on these machines? Oh, up here. Yes, thank you. Sorry. I'm still in the generation that grew up with blackboards. I guess that's about as good as we can get. Look at the interesting shift here. Reification is where you take an idea or a generalization or a concept and treat it as if it's an actual thing, if it's actually something almost material. That there was, in the 15th century still, a lot of talk about faith. That gradually declines as you move into the 16th and 17th century, reaches a kind of low point in the 18th time of rationalism. Look at the usage of the term religion, and look at then how these are supplanted by a reified term like Christianity, a more abstract term that most of us would think of not so much first of all, in terms of piety or the quality of one's faith, but as a set of beliefs and customs and so on. I think this shift here is extremely important. Reification, incidentally, I've got a couple of definitions. It's to make an abstraction material or concrete. For example, to reify an abstract concept, to treat it as if it's something in itself. We often talk about religion, but what really is religion? Religion is people praying and worshiping and experiencing forgiveness and so on. Question? Smith is an extremely good scholar. He based this on, and it's been a, I can't give you specific names here, but when you read a book like this and also have confidence in the scholar, you at the time make a judgment as to whether you think the argument is convincing. He would have based this on very, very careful analysis of texts and writings, primary materials from the periods he's talking about. Sorry. Oh, this, no question. He's talking about the use of the term in the West, and he's not making the claim. In fact, he is making the claim that this reification was prominent in the West, and I think cannot be found or could not be found nearly as much in the Orient, although that is shifting too under Western influence. So he's talking here specifically about the use of the term faith and religion and Christianity in the West, mainly during that period would have been Europe. This is the kind of thing, incidentally, that you wonder, you can only admire the painstaking kind of scholarship. This is the kind of thing that today with a computer, you can get conclusions in minutes or maybe an hour or less that would have taken years to get when you were reading these texts one by one. In fact, one of the articles that I assigned this week, the article on from the Law Journal on the Supreme Court's use of the term sectarian, that would have taken an incredible amount of time to do without Lexis and Westlaw and so on, and the computer. And in fact, the basic insight almost was given to me just by running some text through the computer and seeing things jump out at you that either would have taken a huge amount of time or it's not even clear that you would have seen it at all if you were reading things one by one. And for certain kinds of research in the humanities and the kind of conclusions that Smith comes to here, we're in a so much better position today to do that kind of research. I have such enormous admiration for the painstaking, careful kind of scholarship, exhausting scholarship that went into work of that kind. Thank you for that clarification. This is specifically about the Christian West. He is not here generalizing, although the earlier comments I made were about the use of the religion more globally, when he said that these cultures generally did not have any term equivalent to our modern term, religion. And in most of antiquity, that was also the case. Now, Smith argues that as faith in God weakened, Christians became concerned about Christianity. More and more the conviction arises, he says, that God reveals the true religion to people. But this is a tremendous departure from the biblical belief and the belief of the Middle Ages that what God reveals is not religion, but rather himself. That revelation in Judaism and in Christianity and Islam, to take these Western religions, was essentially God communicating something about his own being, not communicating in the first instance a set of abstract truths. Now, that's not to say that in Judaism and Christianity there was not also propositional truth. Jews certainly saw Torah, Decalogue, and so on as God's revelation. It's not an either-or. It's rather to stress the fact that the later reification and abstraction and thinking mainly in terms of do you have true ideas is always, it seems to me, based on Smith's observation, a kind of secondary phenomenon. That the initial, the primary reality, for instance, for Jews, was God delivering them from slavery to Pharaoh, bringing them through the Red Sea into the Promised Land. That was the kind of primordial experience of the living God. And as we shall see later, that could have been interpreted in various ways. It's not just the event, but also how it's interpreted. Now, Smith concludes that the religious person is not attracted, first of all, towards religion, but towards God. She is not concerned, first of all, with an abstract set of ideas, but with the realm of the transcendent, with God himself. And this is a very, very important insight, I think, to keep in mind, and it is why, in some ways, the study of religion in the university is so problematic. I mentioned in one of my first two lectures how odd it would be if we told the physicist or the chemist, you may talk about what physicists and chemists have done in the past, but you may not do any experiments in the laboratory. You can only analyze and reify and objectively look at what others have done, but you can't be involved directly in studying chemical reactions and so on. But to a very considerable extent, that's the way the study of religion is carried on almost entirely in the modern university. Whereas one at least could conceive of the study of religion, and of course the term itself then becomes problematic, in terms of a mixture of ideas and analysis and historical record and encouragement for people to pray, to worship, to try to experience the reality itself. But of course, that's very, very problematic in some ways in a highly pluralistic society. But I think it's important intellectually that we see some of what the problem is. And that brings us, I think, to one of the hallmarks of the modern university. Maybe 20 years ago, in fact, it was probably closer to 30 years ago now, time flies. I was teaching at Earlham College, a small Quaker liberal arts college in Richmond, Indiana, and I was teaching a graduate seminar in their small graduate school of religion, probably one of the first graduate seminars in environmental ethics in the country. The college was very tolerant of my growing interest in this subject in the early 1960s, long before most people were thinking about these issues. And I can remember in this small graduate seminar on environmental ethics, we were about 4 or 5 weeks into the course, and there was this one young woman, maybe 23 or 4, 25. Barbara Thomas was her name, and she was very quiet. And she didn't, I don't know if she said a single word, really, except hello and so on, during the first 4 or 5 weeks. But you can almost always tell when you're in a small seminar setting whether a student is listening or not, and you can watch a person's eyes, and I knew she was listening to every word that the other students and I were saying. She was very, very much involved, albeit she didn't say anything. Suddenly one day, just out of the blue, she banged her fist down on the table and she said, "Damn it, you use your mind just like a weapon." And my first reaction was, "No, I don't!" Except I didn't say it. I restrained myself. I was tempted to say it. And it hit me right between the eyes. And I realized she was right. I love to argue. I always have. It's always been like a good chess game, like a good game of tennis. And sometimes I get carried away in the argument. And instead of searching for truth, I am almost solely intent on winning. And it's very easy to be domineering and to manipulate and to abuse the other person intellectually, just through a kind of relentless attention to the argument and not to the larger context of feeling and ambiguity and so on. And that brief comment was extremely important for me in my intellectual growth. It's one reason why teaching is so interesting and so exciting, because teaching at its best is always a two-way process. I never know when I start a course or a seminar how my life will be different 14 weeks later. Because one of you may ask a question or make a comment or pull a Barbara Thomas on me. And it's a two-way process. And as I thought about it, I realized, yes, that there is something in our language, our way of proceeding in the university that's extremely aggressive. We talk about hard facts, keen minds, sharp ideas, a barrage or volley of questions, a devastating critique, incisive arguments. And we go on and on. It's extraordinary language. We don't want soft facts. We want hard facts. And yet as we think about understanding and knowledge and insight, we realize that understanding sometimes is very soft. Think of the experience, for instance, of sitting by an Adirondack lake in late September as the leaves are changing, perhaps early in the morning, and the mist is just slowly rising off the water. It's still. It's a kind of mystery, a kind of subtlety about all of it. Nothing hard about that. Think of the experience of a mother nursing a baby. It's a very soft and gentle, for the most part, experience. Making love. Think of many of the most important experiences. As I look out, and it's one of the great privileges of teaching, as I look at your faces, each one is different, unique, interesting. And sometimes I'm so preoccupied with myself that I don't notice you and I don't remember your names. That's tragic. And as I look at your faces when teaching is what it should be, and when I restrain my aggressive love of argument, I don't want to attack you. I don't want to somehow knock you out with an incisive argument. I'd like to understand you. I'd like to see how you see the world and how we're different and alike and what kinds of things we have in common. And it's a very subtle and dynamic experience, so very different from our language that we use in the university. Because understanding, and this is really what Barbara Thomas was saying, and that comment of hers then provoked me to do a lot of reading on the subject. So almost none of these ideas are original. They're almost all borrowed from other writers, from some of the Taoist poetry, from some of the mystical writings of Christianity and Judaism and Buddhist writings and Theodore Rozhak, many authors. When we really reflect on the nature of understanding, we realize that we have understanding at many different levels, and it comes in many different ways. Some kinds of understanding you don't get unless there is a certain degree of commitment or trust or love, simply because the other person will not take the risk of revealing himself, herself, to you unless the other person feels that she can trust you, that he can trust you. And love is a kind of precondition for certain kinds of understanding. Some kinds of understanding just takes a lot of time. Doesn't happen quickly. And it's not sequential and logical. A lot of understanding in the humanities, the kinds of things that come to us through poetry and drama and literature, it's not logical. It's like spending an hour with a friend here and then a week later another hour and then encountering the person unexpectedly here. And it's sort of a whole range of experiences, different kinds of experiences that gradually build up a certain understanding. And sometimes we can't even begin to rationalize what's really happened. Think of a writer such as, take Dostoevsky, for example. I can still think of the enormous excitement when I first discovered Dostoevsky. I hadn't read anything of his in high school or even in college, and my first year in graduate study at theological study at Princeton, I discovered Dostoevsky. It was almost a huge mistake because I practically flunked out the first semester. I stopped reading anything else, and for 6 weeks I just immersed myself in Dostoevsky. I couldn't believe that there was such stuff. It was wonderful. Fortunately, I had a professor who was wise enough to sort of gear into that and help me understanding, but then also suggested that I might want to do a little studying other than that. I'm very grateful. But if you look at a writer like Dostoevsky, how do you explain someone like The Idiot, for instance? Prince Mishkin. How do you really rationalize someone like Alyosha or Ivan or and so on in the Brothers Karamazov, Dmitri? I don't think Dostoevsky himself first started out with a kind of a personality profile, kind of sociological, psychological analysis of these figures, and then somehow put them into his novel. He had a kind of experience, which many great writers have, of the characters leading him, a kind of holistic, intuitive response of what Prince Mishkin was really like, and then he has to write. He has to be honest to that kind of vision. It's why the poet, the artist, and others speak of the muse. They speak of the vision. They are like Einstein, who says, it was given to me, and sometimes more than given, almost compelling me. Think of some of the Hebrew prophets who, in effect, said, Lord, we don't want to be your lousy prophet. It's too hard. We'd rather do something else. But they felt the burden of the Lord, as they put it, to speak truth to Israel. There's a sense in which one is almost inspired, taken over, driven in a certain sense by the vision. All of that, it seems to me, is part of understanding. And as long as we think of understanding just as that kind of objective, quantitative, analytical distancing of ourselves from reality, we will at best have one kind of understanding. Very useful. This is in no way to take away from the intellectual excitement and the social utility of science and technology and numbers and graphs and statistics. Very useful stuff. And our lives are much, much better because of these. But when one wants to say, as some do, and to some extent the whole university says, that this is what it's really all about, and the other stuff is all soft and vague and non-empirical, and you can't back it up with numbers, that's another matter. Because it seems to me that the reality is that we have quantitative, objective, analytical knowledge, and it's very useful, but we also have other kinds of knowledge or understanding that cannot be argued mainly from the basis of numbers. The mother does know a lot about the infant that she can't quantify or can't articulate easily. Try describing to someone else how you ride a bike. I'm not even sure the physicists have mastered that in all the exact formulas and so on. It's very tricky. And yet, you clearly know at some point you've learned how to ride the bike. Many other skills of that sort. So that knowledge in our actual lives is usually something much more than just quantitative analytical knowledge. And I think that's partly why Wilfred Cantwell Smith's work is so interesting. Because if one simply studies religion and thinks that one really knows what's going on, it's like an individual perhaps who's read a lot of Kinsey or statistics or books on sex and love and so on, but has never made love, has never had a friend, a close friend, and so on. There are different levels of understanding, and in some ways, it also seems to me that Smith is right, that the reification, the abstraction, the analysis, the objectifying can in some ways hinder us from the reality itself. Doesn't need to. I think there can be a more harmonious working together of objective knowledge and more subjective kinds of understanding. And even that division, as we will see later, is not altogether accurate. But frequently there is. What I'm suggesting is that education at its best ought not to be that kind of situation that I think it's Ortega y Gasset or another Spanish philosopher has described, the kind of picture of the rich landowner sitting on the balcony of his city home, his village home, where he has his cool drinks and his servants, and he sits there very removed from the hoi polloi, the hustle and bustle in the street below, the carts breaking down and the people cursing their animals and arguing and laughing and so on. He says that's not the way life or even the life of the mind is, that we sit here aloof and dispassionate and disinterested observers. He says knowledge and living and understanding also involves being down on the street, being part of the hustle and bustle of actual living. That knowledge, in some respects, cannot be gained just sitting on the balcony. That, I think, is part of the incredible problem that we face today in trying to deal with ethics in the university. Courses in ethics have often been extremely abstract, very analytical, often focus on the really tough problems, the so-called dilemmas, the border problems, the ones that we really don't know how to solve. And a lot of students, as Christina Hoff Summers writes in a recent article, go away from a college course in ethics more or less convinced that nobody really knows the answers to any of these things anyway, so I might as well do what I want and what I feel like. Ethics is not just that, it seems to me. It seems to me at least part of the concern is that we learn to be better people, that we learn to live better, that we learn to be more just, more sensitive to one another, and in this course I will argue to the environment. And it somehow seems to me that the idea that the university is the place where you just treat everything at arm's length, the professor should have no immediate interest in students becoming better people, but only in their becoming, having more developed brains and more information, that idea just seems rather quaint to me. We certainly wouldn't treat a doctoral degree or even a master's or even a bachelor's degree in chemistry that way, that you only read books about chemistry but you never learn the skills of lab work and get into the rough and tumble of actually knowing how the discipline works. There is a place for the history of art, but it's also wonderful to take a course that involves actual potting or some actual painting. It'd be tragic if all we did was read books about sports and never played, or books about backpacking and time in the wilderness but never got into the wilderness. So what I'm trying to suggest is that the idea that Wilfred Cantwell Smith is dealing with here, I think, is relevant not just to religion, but in a way to much of our lives and our lives in the university. If education is genuine, it seems to me it is always risky. You never really know what is going to happen. And I think the existentialists are right at that point. I'm not an existentialist, but I think they're right on this point, that authentic existence is relating to one another and the world about us so that our very selfhood is at stake and at risk. We're not constantly guarding ourselves, closing our minds, pulling back from the possibility that our ideas and our actions and our interactions may change one another. And that university education at its best ought to be a balance. There's a great place, perhaps a dominant place, for abstraction and analysis and quantification and objectification. Not disputing that. But unless it also involves courses and encounters where there is the risk of really meeting one another and really meeting the great ideas, that incredibly electrifying experience of picking up The Idiot or The Brothers Karamazov, or you pick your favorite author, and not being able to put the book down and almost walking about in a trance because you're living in another world. It's a great experience, and it's too rare, it seems to me, in the modern university. I wish I knew how to make that work. I don't. I do have some ideas. But we really don't know that much, I think, about teaching. And one of the reasons I think we sometimes avoid it is that teaching is risky. It's not easy in some ways to admit your own fallibility and your own ignorance. I'm speaking of myself, not you. Your own lack of understanding of so many issues, or the fact that I have more questions now than I did 40 years ago. It's particularly hard in a course that deals with ethics and religion, and that's why I said I sometimes wish I were teaching chemistry or something, because ethics and religion is a little more like, as I understand the discipline, not everyone understands them that way, but it's a little more like teaching painting or potting. You have to be able to do it in some ways, and it seems like a kind of contradiction on the one hand to be aware of those injustices, those failings, those shortcomings in your own life, and then appear at 9 o'clock on Tuesday and Thursday and talk about justice and all these good things. It's really hard. And I think it's why times avoid this, because you become vulnerable in teaching, as I see teaching, at least to some extent. And the fact that one of you may pull a Barbara Thomas on me is a little uncomfortable. And it's happened. It happens rather more often than sometimes I like, and yet, obviously, in other ways, I'm very, very glad that it does. I think we're going to see, and I'll develop this at some length, that the preoccupation with quantification and domination and manipulation and control is not only one of the big problems in our relating to one another, but I would argue, and I will make this case at some length in a few weeks, it's one of our big problems in relating to nature. Because nature is not just a resource. It's not just a thing. It is a presence. It is something that in strange and beautiful and subtle ways can change us. And it's much more comfortable just to control and manipulate and use it for our own benefit and not to be more open to its intrinsic value and the ways that it can speak to us. It's part of the frustration of the course. It almost ought to be two semesters because we ought to spend a couple, 2 or 3 weeks on some of the Taoist poetry. We ought to look at some of the insights of Native Americans and others towards nature. And it's very frustrating to try to do this in one semester, and there are trade-offs, so that you at least want to do one or two things well. But even though we're not going to do all of that, I at least want you to be aware that it could be done and it would be very valuable to do it. Well, I've wandered quite a bit. I hope not irresponsibly. That's all for today.